Not far to go, lads. Nearly there.
The date is April 2nd, 1942. Night has fallen on Dutch Timor. Following the death of Pilot Officer Peter Thompson, my grandfather, Flight Lieutenant Brian Rofe, commander of the rear party that has been hiding from the Japanese in the jungles of occupied Timor for 6 weeks, takes the airmen from the village of Kapsali, where they've been in camp for a month.
Come on, chaps, not far now.
The airmen are heading for an emergency landing ground, or ELG, at Tuakau, 23 kilometres south along the coast. They've crossed crocodile-infested rivers and forged a path through thick jungle. Some of the sick are carried on makeshift stretchers, fashioned from bamboo and reeds. Now they've arrived at Cape Karoo's, only 3 kilometres from their destination. The tide is surging around the cape. Brian consults George, the group's Timorese guide. George says they must move immediately. At high tide, the surf explodes on the jagged boulders at the base of the cliff. The water isn't that high up yet, but they haven't much time. If they're cut off, the only way to Tuakau is hiking inland through the jungle, and that route will add a full day to their journey to the ELG. Brian surveys the group. Everyone is either sick, starving, or a combination of both. The stretcher bearers are exhausted, and there's no way they'll be able to carry the sick around the cape without dropping them in the surf. And then there's a radio. If seawater seeps inside, the game is up. But Brian figures they have no other choice. They have to keep moving.
Heads up! Watch that wave! Keep it up, lads. Not far to go.
The radio crew, comprising the fittest men in the group, go first.
Where's George gone? I can't see a bloody thing! George! Keep the radio out of the water!
Leading aircraftman Len Burke is in the group, and although his torn clothes and worn-out boots give him a dishevelled appearance, his health has improved. Flying Officer Arthur Cole leads them, and they lift the heavy equipment high over their heads and stagger into the sea. Brian remains with the sickest men and orders those on stretchers to each be lifted onto a pony.
All right, everyone. We're nearly there. Get those stretcher cases onto the ponies. We have to go now.
Aircraftman Jim Graham is in the worst shape. Malnourished, weak, and racked with fever, Jim's been in poor health since pulling his great mate Len Burke out of the creek back at Kapsali. It takes four others to lift Jim onto the back of a pony. Brian has one man stand either side to prop him up. One of those men is leading aircraftman Clyde Pappin. Here's Clyde recalling the moment 70 years later.
And we were caught. We were going along the coast, and the sea where the tide was coming in. We had to hurry, but we were right at the foot of a cliff. And we had Jim on a horse, a Timor pony. I thought then, oh, he's going to fall off. He wasn't looking too good. And he would have fallen, I think, if we had held him.
They enter the surf, and the water breaks across the pony's hindquarters.
I can see the beach! Hey, watch those rocks! Jump in that wave!
They battle on until a surge of water knocks the pony sideways, throwing Jim into the sea. Clyde and another man desperately lift Jim out of the water. They drag him up the beach. Jim isn't moving. Someone comes forward with a bottle of whiskey, thinking a tot will give him the boost he needs. Clyde presses the bottle to his lips. Jim turns his head away. They lift him back onto the pony. The pony wickers as each wave washes across the animal's legs. Halfway around, Jim starts groaning. He's in agony. He begs to be let off the pony, begs to be allowed to rest. But there's no going back. The airman leading Jim's pony can see the beach on the other side of the promontory, just 50 more metres.
Not far to go, Jim. Hang in there, mate. Nearly there.
By the time they get to the beach, Jim's arms hang either side of his body and his head sags into his chest. They get him down off the pony, and he's limp in their arms. He's not breathing. Clyde spends half an hour trying to resuscitate him, but it's no use.
He died on the horse. He was only about 19.
High on the beach, a grave is dug using tin hats. Before being lowered into the ground, they strip Jim of his boots and clothes. Brian conducts a short service before the party resumes the march south. But the hope of rescue is no longer at the forefront of each man's mind. Instead, their thoughts turn to Jim and his best mate, Len Burke. When they arrive at the ELG, Brian and Flying Officer Bill Arthur go in search of Len. They find him, not well, sitting on the beach on his own. Earlier on the march, he'd taken ill and vomited violently. They tell him about Jim.
Yeah, I was so shocked. This is the part that makes me get a bit emotional.
Len asks to be left alone again so the men will not see him cry. Brian and Bill get to their feet and set Jim's boots next to Len. They pat him on the shoulder and let him be.
Men and women of Australia.
Australia! You are the sons and daughters!
I'm Tom Trumbull, and this is Trapped.
Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack. A state of war exists between Australia and Japan.
The story of one of the greatest escapes of the Pacific War. Chapter 4. The ELG. Brian immediately inspects the beach on arriving at Tuakau. Arthur Cole is right. It's a perfect ELG. Flat and hard, you could land a heavy bomber on this beach without trouble. Brian tells his senior wireless mechanic, Ron Bell, to signal Darwin that the ELG is perfect. Darwin's response is immediate.
No aircraft available for rescue.
Brian is bewildered and irate.
I could never understand why Darwin made no mention of the landing ground. Maybe they thought I was a bit delirious with fever in suggesting a beach. But gee, it was perfect.
The gamble to head south in the hope of forcing Darwin's hand has backfired. The airmen no longer have a perpetual water source in the Kapsali River. Their food supplies are badly depleted, having had to leave the bulk of the rice back at Kapsali, owing to its weight. The 23-kilometre hike has made previously fit men sick, and sick men teeter on the brink of death. Worst of all, the hike has killed Jim Graham.
Pergi kek Kapsali.
They desperately need food. Brian pays George to bring the rice supplies they left back in Kapsali, and then gathers the men in a hut the chief of Tuakau made available to the airmen.
I've sent George back to Kapsali to get the rice. I've also told Darwin to send us supplies. Until Darwin can find us another flying boat, we stay put.
Brian tells them George will soon return with the food, and in the meantime, he's requested another supply drop. There's nothing to do but wait. Brian sits down, exhausted, and on the verge of another malaria attack. Flying Officer Arthur Cole surveys the men and their leader. In Arthur's mind, Brian is failing. It's clear that if they remain here, they'll all die. Arthur's not going to let that happen.
All right. Here's what I propose we do. There's a lifeboat the Yanks left on the southern coast. It's big enough for us all.
Arthur proposes a hike of nearly 100 kilometres over a mountain to a fuel dump along the southern coast. From there, Arthur and the volunteers would roll a barrel of fuel 8 kilometres along a rocky beach to an abandoned lifeboat, whose exact location Arthur seems to remember.
Once we fill the tank, we'll bring the boat back.
After filling up the boat's engine with fuel, they would launch the boat through a treacherous surf before motoring round the southern tip of Timor, waters choked with Japanese shipping, all the way to Tuakau. A total of 35 men would then pile into a boat equipped to hold 16. With no water and nothing to eat but rice, they'd have a sea voyage of around 800 kilometres back to Australia. Leading aircraftman Eddie Park, one of the jokers of the group, breaks the silence. This is Clyde Pappin recalling what was said.
Cole, he said, all those that will come with me will go south. Put up your hand. And Eddie Parks, he never said a word for a while, but then he said, sounds like another one of your harebrained schemes, but he said, I'll give it a go.
Arthur, that's the most harebrained idea I've ever heard. Count me in.
We all burst out laughing. It sounded so funny. And, you know, that fixed it. Once we got everyone laughing, they said, well, we want to separate for, we're all right.
His leadership assured, Brian sinks into the dirt and gives himself over to the fever. The following morning, Arthur comes to wake Brian. It takes Brian a few moments to register what Arthur is telling him. Inside the hut he shared with Len and Clyde, Private Clem Clements lies dead. It is perplexing. Clem had been no more affected by malaria than anyone else. In fact, he seemed to be recovering. Clem's body is placed on a stretcher and carried to the ELG for burial. Before lowering him into the grave, one of the men notices dried blood on Clem's shirt. It's pulled back to inspect the wound. The skin is smooth, but for two puncture marks under his arm.
On Wednesday, April 8th, Private Clem Clements of the 2nd 40th Battalion, who I'd brought along as he had been working continuously in the cipher office in Koh Phang, died from a snake bite.
After Clem is buried, Brian calls over the rest of the party.
I'll say this for Clem Clements. He did his part. He helped out.
No one knew Clem all that well. As an army man, he'd remained an outsider. But Brian knows Clem was a contributor, a man whose skills in cipher had been incredibly useful when Brian was ill, and a crack shot who hunted deer and wild boar during the long stay at Kapsali. Throughout the journey, he'd never complained. He'd done his bit for the party. That was all Brian had asked. The moment Clem's service finishes, George returns with the consignment of rice that had been left in Kapsali.
Bos besar, dengarkan aku, bos besar. 300 pasukan Jepang ada di Kapsali.
George finds Brian and starts talking rapidly in Malay. 2 days earlier, he tells him, an enemy patrol landed by boat at Naikliu, where Brian had gone for supplies. Latest reports have them encamped at Kapsali. It's not hard to work out what's happened. Facing the prospect of torture or execution, a Timorese villager has told the Japanese about three Australians who came up from Kapsali on a supply run. George doesn't know the exact number of soldiers that comprise the patrol, but there are said to be many of them, and they're only 4 hours away. Brian has Ron send an emergency message updating Darwin on the enemy patrol. Darwin recommends radio silence until the patrol has passed. It's a good suggestion. Fear of the patrol being guided by direction finders, technology that can detect radio signals by triangulation, is intense. But Ron can still receive signals without being detected. So before Ron signs off, he signals the 2 times each day he would keep a listening watch. At the exact same moment, Darwin signals 2 different listening times. So Ron sends back another signal seeking clarification. Darwin responds immediately, but it's not in response to Ron's request. Ron jots down the message and hands over the piece of paper to Brian for deciphering. It's short and unprompted, as if it came to Darwin's radio operator as an afterthought. It says,
Do you have a way of shining a light out to sea?
Thursday, April 9th. The USS Sea Raven, an ultra-modern Sargo-class submarine, charges across the black surface of the Savu Sea. Sea Raven is running 1,500 rounds of anti-aircraft ammunition to Corregidor in the Philippines. En route, Sea Raven's new captain, Lieutenant Commander Hiram Cassidy, is handed a signal from Commander Submarine's Asiatic Fleet, or COMSUBS. Cassidy notes the signal in his logbook.
When midway between Sumba and Savu Islands, received a signal directing this vessel operate offensively against the enemy north of Timor.
The supply run is off, but that doesn't explain his new orders. Sea Raven is operating with a reduced arsenal, a full complement of torpedoes having made way for the 50 tons of high explosive it's transporting. Surely the sensible decision is to run back to port, unload the cargo, reload the torpedoes and go hunting. Something doesn't add up. Then, another signal.
April 11th, 1942. Received serial directing this vessel rescue about 29 Australian troops stranded 1 4/10 miles south of Cape Kourous on Timor.
From their present position, Cassidy calculates he'll make it to the rendezvous point about 2 kilometres off the Timorese coast on the afternoon of the 13th of April. Cassidy orders Sea Raven to set a new course, and then he turns his mind to the rescue. A submarine has never been used to rescue displaced Allied servicemen from an enemy-held territory in the Pacific. There's no manual for this sort of thing, and it's complicated by a whole lot of unknowns. Cassidy will be taking his men into poorly charted waters that are believed to be shallow, full of unseen reefs and dangerous shoals. Sea Raven will have to surface a distance off the coast to avoid those dangers. After contact is made with the Australians, he'll then launch the wherry, a 16-foot wooden boat stowed in the submarine's superstructure. A crew of 3 men will row the wherry to the beach. Given the possibility of a strong surf, there may be the need for a strong swimmer. He also needs a man willing enough to swim to a shoreline potentially crawling with enemy patrols. Cassidy's got just the man for the job. Ensign George Carlton Cook is a naval reserve officer originally assigned to the submarine tender USS Otis. He's aboard Otis when she's bombed at Cavite in the Philippines at the outbreak of war. The tender ultimately ends up in Fremantle, Western Australia, where she operates out of the largest submarine base in the Southern Hemisphere. But Cook finds the work of servicing and supporting submarines tedious. He's desperate to join the fight. His chance comes aboard the attack submarine his boat is docked alongside. Cook puts in a request to transfer, and his request is approved. In a service comprised entirely of volunteers, Cook's eagerness to serve on a submarine is looked on favourably. 9 days into his first ever war patrol, the skipper is going to give Cook the chance to prove his worth. He offers him the command of the wherry. The success or failure of the rescue will largely fall on Cook's shoulders, and Cassidy tells him to brief the crew and find 2 volunteers. With half the ship's complement squeezed into the mess, Cook briefs the crew on the mission.
All right, listen up. The supply run to the rock is off. We go into a Jap-held island called Timor. There's about 30 Aussie flyers who have got themselves stranded on this island, and they're looking for a ride home. This ain't gonna be easy. We've got to do it at night.
Owing to the rendezvous point being close to an enemy naval base, the rescue will be effected under cover of darkness. He also tells the men that there's a real possibility that the Australians have been captured and are being tortured into signalling for help. That scenario would mean that Sea Raven is being lured into a trap.
I need 2 crewmen. So, who's coming with me?
2 men volunteer. Joseph McGreevy, signalman first class, and Leonard Swede Markison, quartermaster first class. With all that is known and unknown about this mission, it's an act of incredible bravery. Sea Raven is in position at the rendezvous point a few hours before sunset. Cassidy takes a look through the periscope, training it in the direction of the beach, and immediately hits on a problem.
A heavy swell was running, causing waves about 6 feet high to break about 150 yards from shore.
There's no way the wherry can be beached, not in that surf. That means the airmen will have to swim out to the boat, and Cook will have to help them out. Then Cassidy sees something else.
Observed a group of 4 men mounted on horseback and another party of 3 men afoot approaching rendezvous. They disappeared into the brush at just about the rendezvous point.
Cassidy is convinced he's just got a visual confirmation that the Australians are at the rendezvous point. Shortly after sunset, Sea Raven surfaces. From atop the bridge, Cassidy looks through his binoculars. He can see lights on the beach at the rendezvous and what looks like a large fire. 4 machine gunners clamber out of the hatch along with a small crew to man the 3-inch deck gun to guard against the unexpected arrival of Japanese boats. Cassidy knows that the Australians have a portable radio, but he's not going to risk a direct communication. Signalling this close to Koh Phang risks giving away the submarine's position to Japanese direction finders. They'd do this the old-fashioned way.
Signaled SR on the blinker gun and within 2 minutes received an answering signal from a point a little to the northward of the campfire. Sent boat into this point to pick up party and signaled beach to this effect.
The sea turns choppy around midnight. To limit the distance between the submarine and the shore, Cassidy reluctantly takes Sea Raven in closer, drawing up once a 30-foot sounding is obtained. In such shallow water, diving in a pinch is no longer an option. The wherry casts off and pulls clear of the submarine. Above the sound of the waves slapping against the wooden hull, Cassidy's voice ghosts across the water.
Good luck, man.
Once the wherry is within 75 metres off the beach, just beyond the surf, they drop anchor. Cook sees 12 men around a campfire. He takes off his shirt and tosses it to McGreevy, who hands him a 45. Cook wraps the gun in a piece of cloth and stuffs it into his belt buckle. He ties a long line to his wrist and grabs the torch. The moment he prepares to jump in, Cook sees something on the surface in his peripheral vision. He turns on his flashlight and shines it directly into the water. The other two men shuffle alongside and shine their torches over the edge. And they count three sharks swimming directly under the boat. McGreevy reckons they are as big as Sea Raven's torpedoes, almost the size of the wherry. These are massive sharks. While McGreevy and Markison are counting sharks, Cook jumps in. The long line that he attached to his wrist is drawing out. Cook is in the surf, hitching a breaker right up onto the beach. The current pushes him about 100 metres from where the group is gathered around the fire. Once on the beach, Cook scopes his surrounds. Beyond the sand, he notes the jungle at its edge, black and impenetrable. He makes his way towards the fire, pulling the gun from his belt as he nears. The sound of the surf swamps the sound of the voices, and the fire is burning low, making it difficult to make a proper assessment of the men around that fire. Cook can't even discern faces. There's only one way to find out who they are for sure. Cook takes a breath, steadies himself and stands up. He turns the torch on himself and shouts.
Hello, I'm George Cook, an ensign in the United States Navy. Come out, show yourselves.
The group of men take one look at Cook and sprint for the jungle. Heart beating out of his chest, Cook approaches the fire and calls out again. He unties the long line from his wrist and secures it to a small log. With the log firmly in the sand, Cook ventures after the fleeing figures into the darkness. On the wherry, McGreevy and Markison wait patiently. McGreevy keeps his eyes on the beach, while Markison is looking seaward when he sees Cassidy signalling on the blinker gun from Sea Raven's conning tower. The wherry is being recalled to the sub. McGreevy grabs his torch and flashes continuously at the beach. It's the signal for Cook to come back. Minutes tick by, and then Markison and McGreevy haul Cook aboard. He couldn't find the stranded airman. All he knows for certain is that the group gathered around the fire were not the Australians. They weigh anchor and return to the submarine. Cook is given the hero treatment back on Sea Raven. He's made his report to Cassidy, and the lieutenant commander concludes that the men around the fire were either Timorese or Japanese. He congratulates Cook and tells him to go grab some chow. In the mess, McGreevy and Markison extol Cook's bravery. Cook is no longer the outsider, he's one of the crew, but he can't shake the feeling that something is being missed. Cook finds the skipper and requests permission to return to the rendezvous point the following night to go searching for those airmen. Cassidy denies the request. In the skipper's mind, the Australians have been captured. The Sea Raven crew has done all they could. He gives the orders to submerge. In the hilly country behind Tuakau, deep in the jungle, the Australian airmen talk in whispers. They've been in hiding for the past 2 days since receiving reports of the Japanese patrol, 300 soldiers strong. Every last grain of quinine and aspirin has been used. All but a few men are dealing with malaria. They are all covered in tropical ulcers. Brian calculates that a third of his men will die in a week if they don't get off this island. There's nothing he can do but wait. As Darwin suggested, they've maintained radio silence out of fear that the Japanese will locate their signals. In fact, there's been nothing from Darwin at all in the 2 listening times Brian requested. The last signal received from Darwin was the mysterious question, asking if they had a light to shine out to sea, and then nothing. Next time on Trapped.
To the Australian officers and soldiers. All Allied forces surrendered to us without any conditions. They are enjoying life and are waiting for you, being supplied with bread, meat, and fresh vegetables. Your movement and present location are reported to us through Rajas. If you continue fighting against us, there is not way but to conquer you. So come to us with this information and await for the return of peace with your friends, Japanese Army.
Trapped was written and produced by Tom Trumbull with Sam Loy, James Milsom, and Ryan Pemberton for the Australian War Memorial.